From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. Sarah Buell is an attorney and activist who identifies with the battered women and children she works with. She was abused by her husband nearly 20 years ago and found that the system was useless in helping her. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Buell. She co-founded the Massachusetts Domestic Violence Council. Also today, combining psychotherapy and a Buddhist perspective, we talk with Dr. Mark Epstein, author of Thoughts Without a Thinker. And Milo Miles tells us about the Further Festival, a reunion of Grateful Dead members and their fans. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. A Secret Service agent in charge of operations at the White House says the Clinton administration overruled the Secret Service in granting White House passes to some employees with a history of drug use. Arnold Cole, in an interview with House investigators released today, said a special voluntary drug testing program was established to allay the service's fears. President Clinton announced today another initiative to fight crime, and it won't cost the federal government anything. The president says his administration has found a source for free cellular telephones for neighborhood watch groups.
This will help our citizens to have stronger links with law enforcement as they work to take back our streets. In the right hands, these cell phones will save lives and stop crimes. When citizens are on patrol, the cell phone will help to keep them safer. When they see something suspicious, a cell phone can bring the police. When they see a medical emergency, a cell phone can connect them to the ambulance service immediately.
The Cellular Telecommunications Industry Association is providing free telephones and airtime free of charge. Peace talks resumed yesterday in Northern Ireland, but the atmosphere was tense. From London, NPR's Michael Goldfarb reports.
The British and Irish governments buried their differences over the causes for last week's rioting in Northern Ireland, but the province's politicians were more interested in talking to the press than each other. The talks chairman, former Senator George Mitchell, issued a statement saying an end to the talks would condemn the people of Northern Ireland to widespread sectarian violence. During the day, it emerged that David Trimble, leader of the Ulster Unionists, the largest Protestant party, met during last week's violence with a leading Protestant paramilitary leader. This led Catholic politicians to question why he refuses to speak with Sinn Féin's leadership, who are connected to the Catholic paramilitary group, the IRA. In another development, Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams will meet with senior Irish government officials today. It's the first contact between the two since the IRA set off a bomb in Manchester last month. I'm Michael Goldfarb in London.
Time Warner said today it's been given the go-ahead to buy the Turner Broadcasting System. The Federal Trade Commission staff gave its approval to the deal, which would create the world's largest media and entertainment company. The FTC commissioners must still provide the final okay, but CNN, Turner's flagship network, reports the commissioners will approve the deal. The company that owns the Fox network is buying 10 more television stations to become the country's largest station owner. Rupert Murdoch's News Corporation is spending $2.48 billion on the deal. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 18.13 points at 5376.88 in heavy trading of 250 million shares. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up 26.46 points at 1079.93. This is National Public Radio News. Following last month's truck bombing in Saudi Arabia that killed 19 American soldiers, the Pentagon will develop a sweeping plan to upgrade protection of its troops in the Gulf and other regions. Defense Secretary William Perry said the plan will be designed to protect against terrorists using truck bombs, as well as nuclear, chemical, and biological weapons. He said it will be costly and require substantial support from the Congress. An international conference on climate is underway in Geneva. The U.S. representative is Timothy Wirth, the Undersecretary for Global Affairs. Today, he called on participants to make binding commitments to fight global warming. In the past, the U.S. has supported only voluntary goals. The E. coli epidemic that has sickened more than 5,000 schoolchildren in a central Japan city appears to be spreading. NPR's Julie McCarthy reports from Tokyo.
The number of children hospitalized with symptoms of diarrhea, nausea, and high fever has doubled since Monday and now stands at more than 400. Health officials are at a loss as to how to stem the worsening threat, and while they suspect school lunches as the source of the bacterium that has set off the sickness, they cannot confirm that with certainty. The outbreak in Sakai City has alarmed Japan, a country which prides itself on cleanliness. Officials announced that all of Sakai's 92 primary schools closed since Monday will not reopen until after the end of the summer break in late August. Scientists from Japan's National Health Institute say they hope the epidemic has plateaued, but with so many questions left unanswered, health officials say their prediction is just a guess. In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
Veteran British rock musician Chas Chandler has died. He performed with the Animals in the 60s, playing bass on such hits as The House of the Rising Sun. He died in London at the age of 57. I'm Nora Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Penguin Books, publishers of Penguin Classics. For 50 years, the definition of classic. Penguin Classics catalog available through email at reading@penguin.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Sarah Buell is a lawyer and activist who works with battered women, abused children, and juveniles in conflict with the law. Nearly 20 years ago, she was in an abusive relationship. She left the abuser with no place to go and no way of supporting her young child. She spent some time on welfare, worked in a factory, and eventually worked her way through college. She graduated from Harvard Law School in 1990. She's a co-founder of the Massachusetts Domestic Violence Council. She directed the domestic violence, child abuse, and rape programs in the Massachusetts Office of Public Safety. She's now the director of the Juvenile Prosecution Unit in the DA's Office of Norfolk County, Massachusetts. I asked Buell if she ever went through the criminal justice system when she was abused. She told me she used to call the police, but was always disappointed by their response.
Their response was pretty much to just come to the house, try to calm things down, maybe suggest that the abuser walk around the block, or sometimes they would take him to somebody else's house. But arrest was really not an option. It was not viewed as serious violent crime the way it would have been had those same assaults been perpetrated on a stranger. And sadly, that continues to be the practice in some communities around the country. But our hope is that in the majority that has changed.
What lesson did that teach you about what you couldn't and couldn't do to protect yourself?
That I was on my own. That there really was nobody out there who either cared or knew what to do to help. And part of the problem was my own shame, and I have continued to hear this from thousands and thousands of battered women that I've worked with over the last two decades, is while there may be people out there who are willing to help and want to help even, our own shame and embarrassment, largely believing that it's something we've done to create the abusive relationship, that if we were only a better partner, a better mother, a better cook, a better house cleaner, whatever, that the abuse would not occur.
What advice have you given police about how to deal with domestic violence when they're called?
It's critical that we start out with helping them understand what's going on for the victim. What are the obstacles to leaving? Because one of the things that not only law enforcement, but most people who are not abused ask is, why would somebody stay? And they get very frustrated that so many victims return to the abuser maybe 3, 4, 5 times before finally being able to leave. So we really have to cover that piece. And I have them tell me, what are the obstacles to leaving? Pretend you have just been beaten by your partner. You have 3 children under the age of 6. He's cleaned out your bank accounts. You have no place to go. You don't know who to call. The shelters are full. Perhaps your law enforcement is helpful, but maybe they're not. It doesn't really matter. You don't have any place to go. And what are you going to do? And just walking them through what are the options. Then we move on to what we want you to do at the scene, and basically teaching them that there are 4 critical components of incident report writing, that they've got to document the statements of the victim, to document the demeanor of the victim. Is she crying, hyperventilating, difficult time talking? Document the injuries and take photographs. And with those 4 things, in about 70% of the cases, prosecutors can go forward even without the victim. So I want the police to understand that while they may be frustrated with the victims not being able to testify, when a battered woman comes into court and says, I'm not going to testify, or tells the police, I'm not going to follow through with a restraining order, we need to hear that as somebody trying to stay alive. That's not a failure to cooperate. That's not somebody trying to act stupid or all the other ways that I've heard it characterized. We need to get into the mindset of what this person is dealing with and the absence of resources.
I'd like you to expand on that distinction between a woman being uncooperative with the police and a woman trying to stay alive.
Well, we seem to understand it if we have an elderly citizen who's witnessed a drug buy and is being intimidated by the drug dealer. If the drug dealer says to this elderly witness, I'm going to kill you if you go into court and testify, or I'll make your life so miserable, I'll terrify you every day so that you're going to have to move or you'll die. And we understand. We charge that as a felony, intimidation of a witness. And yet that almost never happens in domestic violence cases that it's charged as a crime, but it's exactly the same behavior. The vast majority of batterers threaten the victim, if you testify against me, one, refuse to pay child support, two, kidnap the children, three, make sure your life is simply torture, I'll stalk you everywhere you go, four, I'll kill you, or some variation of that, clearly constituting intimidation of a witness. This is somebody trying to stay alive, and yet in most criminal justice literature, it's written as failure to cooperate.
Is a woman often in more jeopardy if she takes her husband's abusive behavior to court?
It really depends on the situation, and that's why we are obsessed with safety planning. We think that safety planning is absolutely the first step that should occur, whether it's done by the police, a shelter, a prosecutor's office, a judge who's dismissing an order should always say you have to first meet with an advocate and complete a safety plan so that we know, is this somebody who's perhaps in denial and still in love with the abuser, and that we should go forward without her? Because then it takes her out of the danger loop but still holds the offender accountable. Or is this someone whose life is truly in danger and I need to get her on the next plane out of here 10 states away, and we may have to give up that case. But we need to make sure that victim safety is our number one priority.
What do you do when you draw up a safety plan with a woman?
We go through very specifically the history of abuse. Has there been a steady increase in the frequency and severity of the abuse, which most often is the case? Is there an increase in substance abuse, an increase in assaults or threats against the children, increase in threats of harm or murder to the victim, or suicide threats? We also have been taught by batterers experts is one of the key indicators that things are escalating to the point where the victim's life may be in grave danger. And we ask her, what is her perception? And a lot of times the victim is the closest to the perpetrator and will just say, I can tell by the way he's acting that this is it, that this time I'm going to get killed if I go back. And we've had enough of those cases over the last two or three decades that we've been monitoring this, where those victims have then been murdered. And we say, okay, well, in law enforcement, we call this a clue. We need to pay attention when victims tell us they believe they're going to be killed. We have to learn how to hear that and not just say, well, my case has to go forward no matter what.
People often ask, why don't women in abusive relationships seek help sooner? What was the first time you sought help, and what kind of help did you get out of it?
The first person I went to was a priest, and I thought, well, this is a great person. He'll, in his infinite wisdom, know what to tell me. And he said, well, maybe you cook too much Italian food. I think you ought to go to a bookstore or a library and get some cookbooks and you know, just learn how to broaden the dinner menu. So I thought, well, that's a great idea. And I went to the library, and I bought a wok, and I bought a little tortilla maker. I thought, you know, I'm going to save my marriage. And it amazed me that things only got worse. Now, I realize he didn't tell me this out of malice. He told me because he didn't know about safety planning. He didn't know that you're supposed to figure out how to hold offenders accountable and protect victims' safety. So we have to talk to our religious leaders, to doctors, nurses, to plumbers, bookkeepers, employers, everybody and anybody that has contact with victims in violent families, so that we all know how to do at least some degree of safety planning, at least enough to send the person to an advocate that can do a comprehensive safety plan.
Who else did you go to trying to get help?
I went to Legal Aid. At that time, they told me there was a 3-year wait to get a divorce, and there was certainly no priority for domestic violence and nobody who could talk to me about safety planning, and there was nothing in between. You either had to get a divorce, and I wasn't prepared to do that at that time for religious reasons. So there really was not much in the way of resources that were known to me, and it breaks my heart how many victims still don't know what are the resources out there. And it also tells me we have to be obsessed with massive community education, with getting copies of safety plans in every bathroom stall in this country, from the courthouses, libraries, museums, schools. Imagine if every employer regularly had them taped up on bulletin boards, if they were regularly run in newspapers and as PSAs on TV. We have a new national hotline number, 1-800-799-SAFE, S-A-F-E. That number should be plastered around the country. It is absolutely inexcusable how many victims don't know where to turn for help.
People always ask, if women are abused in a relationship, why don't they just leave? Was it hard for you to leave?
It's probably the hardest thing I've ever done in my life, because abusers are so good at convincing you it's your fault. By the time I left, I truly thought I was one of the stupidest, ugliest, most incompetent people that had ever walked this earth. Thank God I was a mother, because I thought, okay, at least I can do this right. But one of the things that is rarely intact when you leave is your self-esteem. And it's critical when people ask, why don't you leave, to ask them to work out the safety plan. You tell me where I should have gone. You know, generally we have no money. Most of us have children. You tell us, go to the shelters. Well, our shelters in urban areas turn away 5 battered women for every 2 they shelter, and they turn away 8 children for every 2 they shelter. So you say, well, just find a homeless shelter. The majority of those won't accept women with children. Of those that do, they can't accept battered women, because our abusers are so tenacious in tracking us down that we do create a danger for the other residents. You say, well, find a sympathetic landlord, somebody just to rent to you till you get on your feet. But we don't have first and last month's rent. We don't have a security deposit. Nobody will rent to us. So you say, well, you're really desperate. Go to a welfare office. They won't rent to you because, or give you any assistance, because you don't have a legitimate street address in the new city or town that you fled to. And even if you do, or you stay in your own town, under federal regulations, they don't have to give you a determination on your eligibility for 30 days. Well, in the meantime, your batterers tracked you down, because we know that one of the most typical behaviors of batterers once you leave is to begin stalking you. Well, by now he's got a box of chocolates, bouquet of flowers. He's real sorry. It's never going to happen again. He's begging you to come home because you're the only one who understands, the only one who can help save this relationship. Or he's got a .357 or a .45 to your head. He's going to kill you if you don't come home. And I ask you, how long do you stay away? You cannot physically live on the street with your children. Your Child Protective Agency will take them away. It's considered neglect.
Did this happen to you, that you left and ended up going back?
I did many times, yes. The first time, I went back because I believed he was sorry. I think most of us are socialized to be forgiving, to give one more chance. We don't want important relationships or marriages to fail because we couldn't be forgiving. And then when I realized that he wasn't sorry and it was going to keep happening, the first job I could get was in a shoe factory. Well, it took me about 3 weeks to figure out I couldn't pay the rent and the babysitter. So yes, we go back over and over and over again, because we don't know what else to do. And for the most part, our communities do not make that information available, and they don't make the financial resources available, such as welfare.
How did you finally leave?
My brother was getting married, and I was able to pack a small suitcase and take my son and get on a bus and get out. But I'm not sure how I would have been able to do it if I hadn't had that excuse. I had been planning it for over a year and was just trying to figure out when I could do it safely.
So he didn't know that you were leaving for good. He thought you were just going to this...
Exactly.
...occasion. And how hard was it for you to get your footing on your own?
It was very hard. Without welfare, I don't think it would have been possible. I went to a small rural town in New Hampshire, and after some difficulty, was able to get on welfare, where I got less than $200 a month for myself and my son. And certainly not enough to live on. Fortunately for me, there was then the CETA program, Comprehensive Employment and Training Act, and the operative word there is training. A lot of us don't have other skills when we leave. And through that, I was able to get a job with New Hampshire Legal Assistance and begin learning about rights, and we started the first shelters and set up transportation networks and safe homes and began writing the abuse prevention laws. But I was very, very blessed. I had a mother that I could turn to. Many victims don't have that. I stumbled by luck into a welfare office that had a wonderful secretary who told me about legal services because initially welfare was going to deny me assistance because I didn't want to tell the location of my son's father. So it truly matters who you run into when you're in the process of fleeing. And for many victims, they just didn't happen to luck into a lot of the wonderful people who have helped me over the years.
My guest is lawyer Sarah Buell. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Sarah Buell. She's a lawyer and activist who works with battered women, children, and juveniles in conflict with the law. You're working in juvenile court now. What connection do you see between violent children and violent parents?
We know that children learn what they live, and children growing up in violent homes take on that violent behavior frequently or act out in violent and aggressive ways. Our Department of Youth Services in Massachusetts conducted a study on the connection between family violence and juvenile delinquency, as did 9 other states. And we found, not surprisingly, children growing up in violent homes have a much higher likelihood of acting out violently, even if they have not been physically abused themselves. Just witnessing their mother's abuse was enough. We found that children growing up in violent homes had a 6 times higher likelihood of attempting suicide, 24% greater likelihood of committing sexual assault crimes, 74% greater likelihood of committing crimes against the person, and a 50% greater likelihood of abusing drugs and alcohol. I call that an impact on the community. And for us to ignore the children, to consistently act as though the only victim is the adult who presents with physical injuries, is certainly done at our peril. And the fact that in every state in this nation, juvenile violent crime is on the increase while most other areas of crime are decreasing is not a surprise. We are not addressing violence in the home in most communities in the ways that we could.
Now, I wonder what kind of position you're in now in court. I mean, you're a prosecutor, so you're prosecuting children accused of violent crime. On the other hand, you're trying to be very understanding that their criminal behavior, their violent behavior, is often a product of an abusive parent.
Well, so, we're trying to change the entire paradigm of practice so that I ask the defense attorney, I want to sit down with you and this young person, and I ask the young person, what is it that I can do? Tell us what we as the adults in your community can and should be doing for you so that you're not robbing stores, so that you're not beating up little old ladies and stealing their money, so that you're not pulling armed robberies or skipping school or doing drugs or the whole array that we see. And some kids, of course, are not responsive to that, but I'm amazed how many are. One young woman, 12 years old, who's sleeping with a 22-year-old man, and her mother just said, well, I can't control her. There's nothing I can do. Mom had had a series of very abusive boyfriends in the home. And when I asked this little girl what she needed, and I mean little girl, this is not a young woman, she's 12 years old, she said, well, I need some structure in my life. I ought to have a curfew. I ought to have somebody keeping track of me. Well, you know, sometimes we ought to just listen to these children, because she's right. And she went on to talk about mom's inability to provide a safe home for her and her sense that it was up to her to do that for herself, and mom really not knowing what were the resources out there and very desperate for love and attention and affection on her own and not really mature enough to parent well, so that a lot of these children are taking on the behavior.
Now, are you often in the position of prosecuting juveniles whose crime is trying to hurt or kill their mother's abuser?
We have had a number of those cases. One of my first cases ever in juvenile court was a young man who came in. His whole arm had been sliced up, and yet he was being charged with assault and battery with a dangerous weapon, a knife, on his stepfather. And I thought, there's something not right here. And the wonderful probation officer involved in the case interviewed the young man, talked to the mother, talked to the accuser, who was the stepfather, and found out that the stepfather had had the knife at the mother's throat, and this 12-year-old child intervened trying to protect mom, and he ended up getting sliced up in the arm. And because stepdad is smart enough to know to come to court and press charges faster than the child could get any kind of help, that's who presented to us. And typically, I think somebody without a background in family violence might have just put that case in and prosecuted that child. It would have been seen as a very serious crime and probably would have sent him to the Department of Youth Services to an in-custody placement. So it really is our obligation to investigate, to figure out what's the real story behind these cases.
Well, once you got the story, how did that change how you dealt with this young man?
Well, we did not prosecute him. We believed that that was self-defense and, in fact, filed charges with the Department of Social Services against the stepfather and began doing safety planning with mom, who realized at that point that things had gone too far and she needed to get a restraining order and have this person out of the home.
When you started practicing law, did the people who you worked with know that you had once been abused? I know now you talk with people about it, and you talk with women who you work with who've been abused about it. But what was your attitude when you started?
Oh, I never talked about it. I was much too ashamed and embarrassed, and I was sure that people would see me as less credible or somehow tainted. And my hope is that by breaking the silence, by saying this is not about being stupid or dumb or crazy or masochistic or codependent, it's about being the victim of a crime. And we need to speak up and end the stereotypes about who are the victims and who are the abusers.
What changed you about speaking out? Was there a turning point?
Yeah, I was at a police chief's training, and one of the chiefs turned to me and he said, "Well, see, a smart girl like you would never put up with that." And I thought, okay, Sarah, you're either serious about doing this work or you're just part of the problem. And I said, "Well, actually, I was abused," and talked to him a little bit about it. And he just said, "Oh, my God, if it could happen to you, I guess it could happen to anyone." And he let me come in and start doing roll calls. And I realized that there was a real power in people seeing me as a prosecutor, as an attorney, as someone who defies the stereotype that they were always saying to me, "But you don't look like a battered woman." Well, this isn't what I looked like 18 years ago on the welfare line. But I have been blessed. And there's so many people who helped me. And I'm determined to be that person for victims currently going through it.
Sarah Buell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Sarah Buell is the director of the Juvenile Prosecution Unit in the DA's office of Norfolk County, Massachusetts. The number she gave for the National Domestic Violence Hotline is 1-800-799-SAFE. That's 1-800-799-SAFE. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, bringing together the insights of psychotherapy with Buddhist teachings. We talk with psychiatrist Mark Epstein. And Milo Miles reviews the Further Festival, reuniting Grateful Dead members and their extended family.
Come take these tears from my face. I can't see through them anymore. Just a feeling I can't trace. And I feel I'm knocking on heaven's door.
knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door. Knock, knock, knocking on heaven's door.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We all have to cope with mental anguish. In the Western world, people often turn to psychotherapy for help in understanding the source of their pain. In the East, meditation and related spiritual practices have helped people quiet the restless mind. Dr. Mark Epstein is a psychiatrist who combines elements of psychotherapy and Buddhist teaching in his private practice. And he's written a book explaining why. It's called Thoughts Without a Thinker. Epstein began studying meditation before entering medical school. At Harvard, he worked with Dr. Herbert Benson, who was a pioneer in studying stress reduction. Psychotherapy deals with neurosis. I asked Dr. Epstein if there's any equivalent concept in Buddhist thinking.
There is not an identical concept as neurosis in Buddhist thinking. Buddhist psychology has always been very phenomenological in its orientation. It was derived from people sitting for many years watching the quality of their own minds. And so what you find in Buddhist psychology is an identification of all the different mental states that can arise in a person's mind and how those mental states can be shaped by the practice of awareness. So there are concepts of greed or hatred or attachment, aversion, and ignorance in Buddhism, but not notions of neurosis per se.
Now, a lot of Freudian analysis traces problems back to feelings of sexual inadequacy or some kind of sexual-related problem, or to problems relating to how your mother or your father treated you. This strikes me as a kind of un-Buddhist way of looking at life.
I'm not sure that it's particularly un-Buddhist. What Buddhism teaches is that all mental anguish is ultimately derived from some kind of craving. The word they use translates as either thirst or craving, some kind of desire or longing for things to be different. And much of sexuality, much remembered experience of one's childhood is colored by those feelings that Buddhism describes as central. So I think that Freud and all the psychoanalysts who followed him were attacking the same problem, almost as if from the outside, peeling away the skins of the onion. And what they saw first was sexuality, and Freud's great discovery, one of his great discoveries, was that children are sexual. Sexuality is everywhere. And when they peeled that away, then what they found was anger. The early primitive feelings of children with their mothers wanting more. And so there was a great interest in anger. And then they peeled anger away, and what they found was insecurity, fear and insecurity, that we're all driven by the sense that we're not good enough, and that's the psychology of narcissism. And as they peeled those layers away, they got closer and closer to what Buddhism has always been teaching.
You write in your new book that you've seen too many people go round and round in therapy, and occasionally they get insight, but the insight brings them no relief.
Yes.
And I think a lot of our listeners will know what you mean.
Yes.
When you say that. But so where does Buddhism come into play there?
Well, I also write, and I've also seen people who have gone round and round in meditation and have found no relief. So I want to make clear that I'm not setting one up as the cure for the other.
Mm-hmm.
But what I have found is that most people, at least in our culture, can make good use of both. and that each has something different to offer, so that what we find in Buddhism is an actual method, an actual technique of shaping the mind, of working directly in yourself, on your own mind, and that that can often make the difference for someone who has done good work in therapy, discovered where they're stuck, but still can't get past it. With the mental power that comes from working in meditation, it's possible really to go beyond where therapy leaves you off.
Can you think of an example of somebody you've worked with who has used meditation and psychotherapy in a complementary way and gone further than you think they would have with either one on its own?
Sure. I can give you certainly one example. A patient of mine who I have worked with for a long time had a disturbing habit of having a great deal of trouble letting go of interpersonal relationships, particularly sexual eroticized relationships, that didn't work out. So he would go out with someone, fall in love with them, have a crush on them, however you want to phrase it. And when the relationship didn't last, he would become obsessed with that person and would feel an inner tension such that he had to pursue them, call them, write them, try to get them to explain what went wrong. And he was, you know, despite lots and lots of therapy, he was unable to stop himself. And what happened was that when I worked with him in therapy, not specifically with meditation, but in a therapy that was colored by my interest in meditation, I tried to get him to stop and feel the emotion or feeling that was happening just before he had to call. And he had a great deal of trouble doing that, but he finally got to a place where he was actually in touch with some kind of painful feeling that was happening mostly in his body that he could identify. He still didn't put this to use for a while, but several months later, he came back into my office and said to me, you know, I finally tried what you said, and instead of calling so-and-so's number when I was feeling this way, I just stopped, and it hurt so much, but I just kept repeating to myself, it hurts, and I didn't have to call. And that was the beginning for this man. That was the beginning of turning away from a terrible feeling of insufficiency and unworthiness that motivated this behavior that only alienated him further from other people. That was the beginning of him turning it around.
Memory is a very important part of analysis. I mean, part of what you're doing is trying to remember your past and make sense of it and understand how the past is shaping your present.
Yes.
What's the role of memory in meditation and in the larger Buddhist way of thinking? And when I say Buddhist, I should say, which school of Buddhism are we talking about that you have studied the most?
Well, there are three main schools of Buddhism, at least that are represented in this country. The first coming from Southeast Asia, from Burma, Thailand, Sri Lanka, and some parts of India that teach a practice called Vipassana, which means insight meditation. Then there's Zen Buddhism, which comes primarily from Japan, China, Korea, and then Tibetan Buddhism. And I've had the most experience with the first, but some experience with the latter two. All of them are very similar in that the core meditation technique is a practice known as bare attention, B-A-R-E, like naked attention, simple, non-judgmental awareness of whatever is happening in the mind and body at any given moment. And the word, going to your second question about memory, the word in the Buddhist language for the kind of practice that is the core technique of all of Buddhism, the word translates as remembering. Because what you have to do is remember in every moment to bring your awareness back to whatever's happening right then. And that sounds simple, but turns out to be incredibly difficult. So in Buddhism, there's much more of a premium, much more importance is put on the here and now, that memories, as we think of them, memories of what went wrong in the past, when they come up, they're to be experienced as they're happening right now, experienced, felt completely, attended to, and then let go of.
Well, now, what positions does that put you in as the therapist? I mean, you're encouraging people, aren't you, to try to go deeper into their memories and understand more of the past. But the kind of meditation that you practice is about mm-hmm. not dredging up memories, but just kind of letting them go by and remaining as much as you can in the present.
As a therapist, I'm encouraging people to be as much as possible in the present. And what happens is that they have a great deal of trouble doing that because of the intrusion of the past. And when the past intrudes upon the present in the therapy office, that's very interesting because that's the material that has brought someone into therapy and that's the material that we can work with. Usually what happens is that there are less specific memories of the past and more a feeling of absence where there should have been somebody or something present. That's usually the kind of memory that comes up these days. It's a memory of an attention that wasn't there. And when that comes up, that's the perfect thing to pay attention to, either in meditation or in therapy.
Tell me more about how you have combined meditation and psychotherapy, what you've learned from each in your own life.
In my own life, I think the way meditation has helped me the most or the most often is in working with my own difficult emotions. I recount in my book a couple of stories about myself whereby even though I was having great good fortune in my own personal life. I had met the person who I subsequently married and had children with and was completely unambivalently in love with, that even then I was still plagued with a kind of childish anger and demandingness that was threatening to destroy the relationship. And it was really by using what I had learned from meditation to both permit those feelings but not be driven by them in cooperation with a good therapist at that time, but it was really by putting into practice what I had learned in meditation that I was able to navigate that difficult emotional territory. And I think in terms of day-to-day life, that's probably the way it's helped me the most.
My guest is Mark Epstein. He's a psychiatrist who's also spent many years studying and practicing Buddhist meditation. He's written a new book called Thoughts Without a Thinker, Psychotherapy from a Buddhist Perspective. Let's take a short break and then we'll talk some more.
Sure.
This is Fresh Air. Back with psychiatrist Mark Epstein, author of Thoughts Without a Thinker, Psychotherapy from a Buddhist Perspective. In your practice, you're trying to combine certain insights you've gotten from studying Buddhism with the work that you do as a therapist. Now, we're in an era where a pharmacological approach seems to really be displacing the talk therapy model. It seems, you know, more and more that people are on antidepressants and other related drugs, and sometimes that's combined with talk therapy, sometimes it's not. And I wonder if you use a lot of antidepressants and other prescription drugs in your practice.
Well, people ask this question a lot. I think you're absolutely right. We are definitely in that era. I feel that one of the two or three things that that I learned in all of my medical school and psychiatric training had to do with the place of these drugs in people's mental suffering. There is definitely a place for them. I do use them when I feel that they're indicated. They are sometimes very helpful. They are by no means a panacea, but when they work, it feels like a godsend. So I do not keep people from using them out of some kind of Puritan or Buddhist ethic that they should be able to cure themselves with the power of their own minds. A lot of people in Buddhist circles or in Western circles of people who embrace spirituality do have a prejudice, which is a kind of backlash against the pharmacological approach. A lot of people do have a prejudice against using the medicine, and for those people, I often counsel, you know, where it's safe, which medicines work, and so on. But I do not think that the value of the medicines outweighs the value of a good talking therapy. And I think what we're actually seeing is a kind of backlash against the pharmacological takeover of psychotherapy, which is happening a lot in league with the managed care companies. And if it's not happening already, I think we'll see soon a resurgence of talk therapy, perhaps influenced by Buddhism.
How do you evaluate whether a person's mental suffering can be relieved by an antidepressant or whether more talk therapy and perhaps meditation is what's advised?
There are certain constellations of symptoms that are a tip-off as to whether a given medication will be of help. If there are a lot of symptoms in the body, difficulty sleeping, terrible anxiety, loss of appetite, difficulty concentrating, those kinds of symptoms will often alert me to the possibility that we're going to have to use medication here. And what I find is that if people are engaged in the therapy process, seem to be making good progress, but are not getting better, then I will start to ask the question to myself and then to them about introducing a pharmacological medication.
Now, you once went with other people from Harvard to study monks who were able to raise their body temperature.
Right.
Did they think that you were crazy coming there with all these fine tools of measurement?
Yeah, I think that they did, especially because one of the things that we had to do was to insert a rectal probe while they were meditating. And it was only because the Dalai Lama himself had asked these monks to please cooperate with us that they... that I think that they were able to. And they just looked at us with this kind of ironical, bemused look while we were fussing all around them. And they were very cooperative.
What did these monks do?
These monks were practicing an advanced form of Tibetan yoga called Tummo Yoga, which translates as heat yoga, in which they raise their inner temperatures so that, for instance, they can sit outside naked in freezing weather with wet sheets draped around their shoulders and dry them with their own body temperature. And these were practices that were documented almost 100 years ago by the French explorer Alexandre David Neal, who wrote a number of rather fantastic books about her journeys in Tibet. And we were unsure whether these practices actually existed or whether she had made them up when we first began the research. And we approached the Dalai Lama, asked him if, in fact, these practices were real, if they were still being done. He said, yes, they were. He could tell us some people who were doing them. And he thought it might be helpful for Western science to see one example of what these practices could do and of what the mind was capable of.
The Dalai Lama wrote the introduction to your book, Thoughts Without a Thinker. And he writes, "The purpose of life is to be happy. As a Buddhist, I have found that one's own mental attitude is the most influential factor in working toward that goal." Do you agree with him when he says the purpose of life is to be happy?
That's actually a very radical statement and also a very Buddhist statement. And all of my Western background rebels against the simplicity of that statement.
Yes, and maybe your parents told you, as mine did and probably everybody's did, that no one can be happy all the time. No one ever said you were put here to be happy.
That's the great thing about Buddhism. People always think that it's a pessimistic religion. Mm-hmm. You know, the first noble truth is that life is suffering. Buddhism has a very bad name for its pessimism, and yet it's relentlessly optimistic. You know, the purpose of life is to be happy. We all want happiness. We're all trying desperately through, usually in the wrong ways, to make ourselves happy by accumulating material things or by feeling that we have to pump up ourselves somehow. And I think the Dalai Lama, I have come to agree with him in spite of myself, is that if we can find the, you know, the right path, that it's not only is it the purpose of life, but it's also a possibility.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Dr. Mark Epstein is the author of Thoughts Without a Thinker, which has just been published in paperback. Coming up, the Further Festival. This is Fresh Air. The survivors of the Grateful Dead and some of their musical friends have been touring together since June. They call the tour the Further Festival. Music critic Milo Miles caught the show outside Boston.
I'll keep on trucking, mama, truck my blues away. I said keep on trucking, mama, truck my blues away. Here you come, baby, big ass sin. Tell what you've been doing by the shape you're.
Whenever I hear the term casual dress from now on, I will think of the Further Festival. When I last saw members of the Grateful Dead on stage more than 20 years ago, the audience was suit and tie by comparison. I guess the barefoot earth mama and the shirtless hippie dude are here to stay. They fit the mood, benign, low-key, self-contained. The Further Festival itself was like watching a parade of little pieces of the Grateful Dead. The Flying Karamazov brothers provided novelty juggling musicians. Alvin Youngblood Hart was a passable neo-blues man. Hot Tuna and John Wesley Harding added a dash of heartwarming old geezer folk rock. Los Lobos and Bruce Hornsby were close pals of the Dead who came to help party down. And two members of the Dead debuted new groups, namely Mickey Hart's percussion ensemble Mystery Box and Bob Weir's edgy straight-ahead rock outfit Rat Dog. Of course, the guy that couldn't be there in the flesh was around more than anybody else. Jerry Garcia's face and famous handprint swarmed on T-shirts and buttons and stickers and signs. The ambiguous nature of all the worship was reflected by Garcia's old mates. Hart offered a wonderfully apt Zen-like homage in Down the Road, a number he wrote with Dead lyricist Robert Hunter. On the other hand, Weir began Rat Dog's set with the refrain, "He travels fastest who travels alone." All the pieces of the Dead put together still lack a huge chunk in the middle, a young and healthy Jerry Garcia. As a cosmic optimist, Garcia kept the Edenic spirit of the mid-60s acid tests alive for the band and the fans. But deep down, Garcia must have known that Dead concerts had started to become like Disneyland reenactments, the very sort of glib, escapist entertainment packages the band originally intended to bury. And as much as the audience wanted to believe, the Further Festival didn't find a way beyond Garcia's tombstone. In their short set, Los Lobos presented tender accordion, sinewy guitar, roadhouse saxophone, and slippery rhythms from a pair of drummers who really did get the job done. But a short set from your friends can only do so much. Now, Bruce Hornsby, who's actually played with the Dead a bunch, is closer to home. That's a problem. He's a warm, welcoming performer who combines the mechanical climaxes of Elton John, the rockless roll of Steve Winwood, and the spineless jazz of Spyro Gyra into a fizzy cocktail that leaves no taste 5 minutes after it goes down. And inevitably, Hornsby was key instigator in the concert-closing jam featuring Weir's Rat Dog. Jimmy Johnson, who played piano on all of Chuck Berry's classic hits, is a member of Rat Dog, and he roils the ivories better than anyone who has played with the Dead. But even he can't displace the overriding Rat Dog image, which is Weir's bad boy lady killer act, an unamusing spectacle. The jam session did manage to poke fun at tough guy stuff with a blustery version of Bob Dylan's It Takes a Lot to Laugh, It Takes a Train to Cry. Then, without much ceremony, the Further Festival ended, and the audience was left with the persistence of memory. The legacy of Jerry Garcia still attracts the nicest and nakedest crowd in rock. But for how long, I wonder? The prognosis for going further is not dead, no indeed, but ailing.
Milo Miles is a music writer living in Cambridge. The Further Festival performs tonight in St. Louis and then heads west. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Amy Sallet, with Alan Tu, Louisa Shafia, and Tracy Tannenbaum. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
I've been a woman about twice my age, lady of nobility, gentility, and range. Splendor in the dark, lightning on the drop. Of the night, we sing in incantations and the candle burning blue. We'll consult the spirits, maybe they'll know what to do. Hell, it's real.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Crown Publishing Group, publisher of Emotional Resilience, Simple Truths for Dealing with the Unfinished Business of Your Past, a Harmony book by Dr. David Viscott. This is NPR, National Public Radio.